Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
And welcome. Thank you for joining us today. The next 2 hours are devoted to learning something more, not just about the world of shoes and ships and sealing wax, but about how, what, and why we believe as we do. A time for the open-minded, willing to challenge some of those old ideas behind what we think we know and who we might become. In today's episode, we're going to examine how we break through self-imposed limitations, limitations that hold us back, keeping us stuck when there is so much more that we want to experience in our lives. We will examine the questions, who we are, where we want to be, and how we can go about accomplishing that objective. So, the question, foremost, how did I get where I am and how do I get where I want to be, becomes our central inquiry in this episode of Breaking Limitations, brought to you by Provocative Enlightenment. Now, enlightenment is a term traditionally used to describe a period in Western philosophy and cultural life, centered upon the 18th century, in which reason was advocated as the primary source and legitimacy for authority. We acknowledge this usage, but we seek to enlarge upon it, adding the idea of experiencing the quintessential truth about ourselves, ever seeking the possibility of an epistemological certainty, that level of noetic knowing, knowing from within who we really are, why we are here, and what we do with our lives. I'm Eldon Taylor, and this is Provocative Enlightenment. All right, our chat room is open, and my partner Ravinder awaits you there now. You can log on by going to provocativeenlightenment.com/chat. We have a great chat room with some very special folks that join us every week, so don't miss out. Join the chat room today. Okay, Rav, it's time for you to invite everyone to the chat room and tell us what makes this chat room so special.
I'm just impressed that you remembered it's provocativeenlightenment.com/chat after all these years of the
Eldon Taylor.
I know. But just for security, I've actually got it at both now, just in case. And so, yes, do come join us. We have a great group of people, great questions that get asked in there. So it's definitely very valuable information as well. So come join us. That's provocativeenlightenment.com/chat. If you can't catch us live, you know, you can still go back to that same page and replay the chat room so you can see some of the questions and stuff. And also on that page, if there are any special offers of any kind, I also post them there, and I post links to, you know, the guest of the day. So there's lots of other information on that page as well. So just go to provocativeenlightenment.com/chat.
And where do you post? I mean, today, for example, we have a video that we're going to be showing of our guest. And where do you post those? Where are those?
That goes directly in the chat room.
So that's
so you have to enter the chat room, and at the appropriate time, I will play the video.
Okay, cool. All right. Beginning this week, we'll be including a new segment to the show that we have decided to call our Spotlight of the Week. This week's spotlight is turned upon the 150th anniversary celebration of the Gettysburg Address. Gettysburg was the deadliest battle fought during the Civil War. Now, consider this quote. Read the Declaration of Independence. Does it form one nation? No. It decrees Georgia, Maryland, Connecticut, and the rest free and independent states. The Declaration fundamentally advocates small government and states' rights. It wants weak local power, instantly answerable to the people. And the Declaration calls rebellion a patriotic duty. The Constitution hearkens to big government, unifying the states. It massively demotes their influence, and in the Constitution, rebellion is treason. Consider further. The Declaration says men are created equal, but the antebellum Constitution sanctioned human bondage. Slavery, states' rights, government power, rebellion. There's your whole Civil War 74 years before the first shot. In 1861, the Union and the Confederacy sought to demonstrate themselves the truest expression of American values. But to do so, each had to cherry-pick from Americans' discordant founding documents. So, Ravinder, it seems to me that in a very real sense that this division over big government versus small government and so forth is still very much alive. Now, you studied American history to become a citizen, and every American learns in public school all about our independence and founding documents, or so one might think till you get into the detail. Your thoughts on this one?
I find the whole subject totally fascinating. You know, I did have to pass an exam to become an American citizen. And through the work that I did at that time, I grew to love America. You know, the very idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the fact that people came here wanting freedom. And to me, freedom is the most important thing possible. You know, I'm aware today government has become too large, and, you know, I mean, I'm not for that, but I had no idea that the problem started right with the Constitution. So that one amazed me too. Maybe it's just the nature of the beast, and which is kind of scary.
It's kind of ironic when you think about it. You know, we can have the Declaration of Independence and everybody can decide, okay, you know, we're going to get rid of big government, you know, Britain. And then you get everybody together following that to form a constitution. And that's, what, the first convention of government, and government expands, go, okay, anyhow, yep. All right, interesting spotlight. Every week, Ravinder's going to give us a spotlight of the week, and we'll carry that out and see where it goes. Now, every week I read some of your letters as our way of paying respect to the very important role you play in making this show successful. Last week, our guest was Dee Wallace. Brian wrote, super show, unless you don't think thinking for yourself is a good idea. Tammy wrote, all of your talk shows are amazing. I love the variety and honesty, real talk. Every week, I can't wait to hear the show. Thanks again for the book and CDs. I was one who spoke with you during your last show on Hay House Radio. Keep up the great work. Well, thanks, Tammy. I remember you, and I'm very glad you followed us over to our new two-hour format. Indeed, I sincerely appreciate the loyalty of so many of you who have stayed with us during our transition, and we're thrilled to have a new two-hour show. Is that not right, Ravinder?
Yes, we are.
So thank you all. Willow wrote, Eldon, you are the best host I've ever heard. I like that. I get so much out of your shows, for you always ask the right questions. Know that you are providing necessary fodder for those of us who are perpetual seekers. Well, I'm truly honored by your words, Willow. Thank you. Tony wrote, I have found amazing results in my life thanks to Eldon Taylor's teachings. They have placed in my heart feelings of gratitude towards life, God, universe, Mother Earth, and all sentient beings. This feeling generates a powerful vibration surrounding oneself with a wonderful energy of abundance, abundance in all things. Well, you know, thanks for your feedback, Tony. And once again, I'm truly grateful for your success. And I'm honored by your words, sir. Ravinder has just put a note in front of me. I'm going to interrupt the letters for a minute. She forgot something.
I've missed something. You know, last week we had Dee Wallace on, and it was a great interview. But she also put together a special offer just for listeners of Provocative Enlightenment. It's an incredible deal. It's over $500 in value in the package, and she's got it for under $100. And, you know, we created a commercial for her, but I didn't put it up on the website. That was an oopsie on my part. So if you are still interested in that, if you go out to provocativeenlightenment.com and just click on special offers, you know, if there are any special offers, any special deals that we can bring to you, then that is where we'll post them. So just go to provocativeenlightenment.com, click on special offers, and you can check out Dee Wallace's special from last week and any other ones that we may have. And there are some pretty cool deals,
including one I really like from our host today, or our guest today, you know, not our host, our guest. All right. Back to the letters. Richard wrote, I have been using your InterTalk programs for a few years now, and I'm very impressed with them. Kenneth wrote, I have so thoroughly enjoyed the books of Mr. Taylor that I wanted to check out the website and get a sample of the InterTalk. And I wish to thank you for your contribution to the world. Your books are a tremendous gift. You know, now for everybody, my website, EldonTaylor.com, or our InterTalk site, InnerTalk.com, we have free MP3 downloads there. And these are not samples. They're the real deal. This is the patented and proven effective InterTalk technology. And, you know, the programs that we offer there are programs that we know form the fundamental basis, the beginning points, if you will, for really taking, you know, control of your own inner talk, your own things. So I invite you all, you know, visit the website and download your free MP3. All right, Lori wrote, your DVD set, Change Without Thinking, was very inspirational to me. Thank you, Eldon. Okay, well, thank you all of you, for your letters and your feedback. Your words often comprise what I think of as my warm fuzzies come bedtime. And those of you who have read my books or heard me speak know exactly what that means. And I don't know what you're laughing about.
I thought I was your warm fuzzy.
Well, you're
sorry.
Not, I hope you're not very fuzzy. You're doing something. Is there a metamorphosis going on
PJs?
I don't know about? All right. That's all the time we're going to take for letters today, but I do invite you to opine by sending your email to eldon@eldontaylor.com. That's eldon@eldontaylor.com, or by joining me on Facebook. We can't get all of your letters on the air, but they do impact our programming. And once again, I both appreciate and thank you for your feedback and continued support. Now, if you're new to this show, you may enjoy our archives. You can find them, well, more than 5 years of archives at the site, provocativeenlightenment.com. During that time, we've interviewed Hollywood greats, politicians, psychics, CIA personnel, heart scientists, skeptics, philosophers, social psychologists, best-selling authors, channels, mediums, and much more. We've charted the waters of parapsychology, psychic phenomena, UFOs, NDEs, physics, psychology, brainwashing, and still more. If any of that sounds like your kind of radio, check out our archives again at provocativeenlightenment.com. Be sure to subscribe to our free newsletter while you're there so you get the announcements about what's coming on next. Okay, now to this week's show, a special episode of our Breaking Limitations series. Breaking Limitations was originally designed to be a telecourse, but the interest was so keen that we decided to make it available as a worldwide radio broadcast. Provocative Enlightenment is a syndicated show and airs on many networks. For more information regarding that, again, visit provocativeenlightenment.com. Check out those schedules. All right, this week's special episode of Breaking Limitations features an absolutely dynamic lady who simply effervesces from her every pore with enthusiasm and joy. Indeed, I first met her at an author's banquet, and her energy was absolutely contagious. We have chatted since then several times, and she appears to be, and I mean this seriously, the living example of her book, Juicy Joy. I'm speaking of the author and author's teacher, Lisa McCourt. Lisa coaches writers, creatives, and other joy seekers who are ready to substantially up-level their success in work and in life. She is the author of Juicy Joy, 7 Simple Steps to Your Glorious Gutsy Self. Lisa has published 37 books that have sold over 6 million copies, won 7 publishing awards, and gone into 11 languages. No wonder she's the author's author. They span all genres, by the way, fiction, nonfiction, children's, adult, and most recently, personal development. As an award-winning editorial director and publishing exec, Lisa has taught creativity for over a decade and is a popular speaker of both writing conferences and self-growth events. Her expertise in this unique blend of skill sets make her a one-of-a-kind facilitator for ushering your dreams into juicy fruition. But was she born lucky, or did she have to struggle before she could succeed? I mean, if so, how? Indeed, did she ever just want to give up? What were her limitations, and how did she break through them? Well, we'll ask those questions today as we find out more about what it takes to break free of limitations and reach even higher. Now, she has already anticipated my question regarding her song of life, and she has informed us that it is Blow Away by George Harrison. Now, you know, as I've said, when someone gives you their song of life, there is some genuine self-disclosure in it. We're going to be taking up that a little bit. So let's get her in here. Welcome to Provocative Enlightenment, Lisa McCourt.
Well, thank you, Eldon. What a great welcome. That is one of my songs of life, and that's one of the really happy, joyful ones, so I knew that you'd really like that one. But more than anything, it's my mantra. When something comes
mantra.
Up that just doesn't work, I have to just sort of sing that in my head when those contrasts that pop up daily for all of us, you know, that thing that we wish were not in front of us in this moment, all I got to do is love you, bank teller who's refusing to do the transaction that I want you to do. All I have to do is be happy. All I have to do, no matter who it is, what's in front of you, you throw some love at it, you decide to be happy, and it's going to blow away, blow away, blow away.
You know, I love it. It is great. It is truly a positive song. It's fantastic. You don't disappoint me one bit. All you have to do is love me away through some of the difficult questions today. Are you ready for that?
Oh, you throw them at me. I got it. I'm ready.
All right, Lisa, our goal here is to develop a clear picture as to how the truly helpful and successful people, such as yourself, have gained the success that they have today. In doing this, we will attempt to trace a path that leads from where you were to where you are today. So to begin with, please tell us about your early years. What was school like for you? Were you popular, a member of a group, a loner? How did you see yourself now looking back on it?
We're just going to jump right in there, huh? Okay. I'm sure. I'm not going to say I'm sure, but I would venture a guess that most of your guests in this particular course teleseries did not have it so shiny, perfect growing up, right? I mean, that's the contrast is what builds us, is what leads most of us into this whole personal development, spirituality field. And it was, I'm sure my story is similar to many. I was very isolated as a child. I think some of us maybe just come into this world more sensitive than others. So sometimes, you know, I don't like to put all the blame on family and upbringing, because I think that what one child might be deeply affected by, another might be able to just coast through because they just don't have the same level of sensitivity. But my mom was a beautiful, vibrant, vivacious, charismatic, fabulous woman who did struggle with some mental health challenges. So as much as I know she loved me, her way of demonstrating that, or just her regular way of being, was to shower me with love and affection and attention until the second that I did anything that wasn't to her liking. And often it would be, you know, not even something I could comprehend why. And then she would just leap into white hot rage. She was a very, very big energy, a lot of emotion always going on. And so I learned at a very young age to be super careful. And all of my energy and efforts went into not setting her off. And that kind of became how I developed myself as this quintessential people pleaser. Just, you know, I just had all the skills down for whoever is in front of me. I can immediately intuit exactly what you would like me to be, and I'm going to become that for my interactions with you. I was just a perfect chameleon. And authenticity was something that really was a skill that I had to build much later in life because of that. I really didn't ever feel safe being my authentic self, you know, expressing myself authentically as a child. So I know that was part of it. And you asked about, you know, popularity. I was not popular in school. As a very young child, it was so difficult for me to express myself that I remember the teachers, whenever they would call on me in class, which was just a terrifying moment to begin with, I would feel like I was yelling as loud as I could because I knew this was an issue, and they would always be asking me to speak up, speak up. They'd have to walk over to my desk, and this would be frustrating for teachers. As you can imagine, I couldn't speak, like actually make words in school. And when we'd be given tests or any kind of like writing that had to be done, they would call in my mom to show them that it looked like I hadn't taken the test. And if you really held it up to the light, you could see just the faintest of lines. And since that was an issue, I remember feeling like I was pressing down as hard as I could with the pencil, but it was just that dangerous to me to express myself. And now I write books and speak on stages for a living. So,
do you? I mean, you know, I mean, you pegged it basically. Everyone that we have interviewed, not one of them was born with a silver spoon in their mouth, so to speak. Not one of them would have been able to plan where they are by way of their career. And in every instance, there was something in their life, and something that was traumatic that had a mobilizing effect in directing the course of where they ultimately ended up going. Now, I can look at this, and you know, the psychologist in me says, "Well, do you believe that there came a point where a compensation mechanism of sorts kicked in and it became important to you to begin to express yourself, that you recognized that you were afraid to express yourself, and so you then worked extra hard at developing those talents and ability, because you're most certainly, you're very exciting as a public speaker, and I've already read out your accolades as a writer, so you're more certainly capable of expression today."
And you're right, and that's what it is. It's always, in the trainings that I do for the Joy students, we learn to love our things that we don't want, the things we deem our unwanted circumstances, because those provide the best springboards to get us where we want to go, right? That gives you the momentum for that kind of shift. I wish I could say it had come early. It actually didn't come for me until, you know, well into my adulthood, when I recognized authenticity. That's the ticket. I used to just study manifestation. I was a huge, you know, metaphysics follower from the time I was a teen, and all of my efforts early on went into learning how to manifest, and I became a kick butt manifester, just world class Olympian level. I wanted it, I could manifest it, but I still didn't have joy. I still didn't have any peace, any like relaxed feeling in my life, until I was able to pinpoint, that's what it is. It's that I've never learned who I am. You know, when you build all those layers over your deepest authentic self, you lose track of it entirely. So once I put all the effort and energy into authenticity and self-love, because they really have to kind of go hand in hand, I believe, that's when the whole Joy program, you know, fell into place, and that's when I realized what was missing all along. When you know, it's like the water the fish is swimming in, right? When that's all you know, you don't know to recognize that, oh, it's because I've never learned how to be authentic, you know?
Right, and so now you say you were, since teenage years, you were very involved in metaphysics. And tell me about your religious upbringing. I mean, what was that environment like?
I did not have any religious training as a small child. I was throughout my whole childhood, really. My grandmother is very religious, very, you know, Methodist, had always been a Sunday school teacher and wanted to tell me about those things. But my mom, I was a teen pregnancy for my mom, and they were in the deep South, and it was just such a tragic disgrace of the family that my grandmother left the church, could never go back, could never do anything with it, and they didn't, you know, bring me up with any religion.
Well, and I find that interesting. Do you think maybe the aversion to traditional religion had anything to do with propelling you towards what we think of as New Age or metaphysics?
I was definitely a clean slate. Yeah, I don't think I ever had an aversion to it. I didn't have enough exposure to have an aversion. I actually had a lot of curiosity about it. I remember going to churches with my friends and synagogue with some of my friends just to try to get a taste and see what it was about. But when I was 14, I read a Wayne Dyer book. I don't know if it was his first one. It was Your Erroneous Zones. The wordplay definitely lost on me at 14, but the message was so powerful for me. I've been an avid journaler my whole life, and if I go back to my journals at that time, everything changed. The way that I wrote in my journals, and I was always just meticulously copying passages.
I'm going to have you hold it. I'm going to have you hold it right there, Lisa. We'll pick it up. We've got a hard break coming up. We're speaking with Lisa McCord about her books, Life and Work. Remember to join Ravinder and her team in the chat room. You can do that by going to provocativeenlightenment.com/chat. Do stay tuned. You don't want to miss what's coming up after a few words from some of our friends.
You're listening to Provocative Enlightenment with Elton Taylor. Have you talked to yourself lately? What does that inner voice say? Are you constantly hearing negative feedback? Ready for a change? Inner Talk, Eldon Taylor's patented subliminal technology, can do just that. Change your inner self-talk. Turn off the negative by replacing it with positive affirmations. Inner Talk has been researched at universities such as Stanford and by governments around the world, and has been proven effective at priming your self-talk. Armed with a new positive outlook, you'll find everything becomes easier, from losing weight to stop smoking, giving presentations to riding horses. Learn new things to being a powerful salesperson. Choose your title for change today. Visit www.innertalk.com. That's INNERTALK.com. Innertalk.com.
Every day, every moment, we face choices. Yet, how many of those choices are truly our own? Are you ready to step onto the path of discovery? Read Eldon Taylor's New York Times bestseller, Choices and Illusions, now revised, updated, and expanded. Eldon combines provocative information, scientific research, and his own life's journey into a powerful message that we have the power to change. All we must do is be willing to choose to take the chance and change. Get your copy today from all bookstores.
Unlock the power of your mind. This is Provocative Enlightenment with Eldon Taylor.
Now, I believe that that was song two that you sent over to us, Play Goo Goo Dolls. Is that right?
I love that song.
Is Iris?
I don't know why it's called Iris, but that's the name of it. I use it in workshops to just get people in that mood. We do all sorts of ways to shift our energy before doing the, I call them naked writing exercises that we do. And for me, that one just, it's speaks what people feel when you don't want the world to see you. You don't think anyone understands, and yet there's that longing. I just want you to know who I am. It gives me goosebumps. Love that song.
It seems very appropriate coming from the conversation we were having about the nature of you deciding that, you know, the problem was you hadn't developed the authentic you. Is that a cornerstone of what you teach today?
It absolutely is. Authenticity and self-love. And I always say those two words, people really don't hear them. They become so cliche and vanilla, and people think they know what it means, so they just sort of gloss over it. So I'm just trying to change the image of those two words because they're so much bigger than people think of them as, right? I mean, everybody thinks that they're authentic, and nobody would ever want to say that they're not being authentic. But it's always just a matter of degree, right? And every time you take that up a notch and get to that next level of being who you authentically are, it's like a whole new ballgame in every area of your life. I really believe that if there's any area of a person's life that they're not just feeling completely juiced and pumped and excited about and experiencing extraordinary success in, it's simply an area where they haven't learned how to be their most authentic self in that area. And becoming more authentic is what will skyrocket it.
Well, now let me remind everybody, in case we just had somebody join us, that we're speaking with Lisa McCord about her life, her books, and her work. And Lisa is an author's author, and by that I mean she teaches authors to write. She has won about every major award there is in writing and done some really spectacular things herself. But where we left off in our conversation, Lisa, before the break, had to do with religion, I probably used the wrong word when I said adverse. Did you have any feelings, that were negative towards traditional religion because of your mother's, lack of a better word, shame that kept her from going back to the church?
I don't think I did as a child, because I don't think I even realized that that was the reason that we didn't belong to a church. I think that was something that became clear in adulthood when I would have deeper conversations about my grandmother, who after many, many years did return to church and is a huge part of her life now. But at the time growing up, it just wasn't something that was talked about. So I don't think that I ever had an aversion. I had a lot of curiosity about
it. Especially, how important is spirituality to you now, Lisa?
Oh, extraordinarily important. I mean, it's all there is now. I just feel that that connection, finding that connection, is essential to joy. And it could be anything. You know, it doesn't have to be the way it's described in any religion. I mean, just finding, knowing that there is something mysterious and wonderful that we can't understand, and believing in the forces of that thing, I think this makes a life dramatically different from someone who doesn't have that belief.
Okay, I kind of want to pack together, you know, the messenger, which is you, the message, which we're going to get to here in a minute, and, you know, how I can use that message, the practicality of that message. And so, you know, packing out the messenger here. Yeah, I think you probably have. But in the Herman Hesse Pulitzer-winning novel, Siddhartha, we discover that spirituality is the way we live every day. So finding our own river, so to speak, where we can live our lives fully aware of our daily duties and still totally participate in true enlightenment is for many the penultimate kind of goal. So what I'm asking is, it sounds to me that if spirituality is everything, it becomes a part of what your teachings are, what your writings are. And I may have that all wrong, so I'm going to ask you to unpack your thoughts on this one for us.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very fair assessment. I call it the universe in Juicy Joy. It's just the way I think of it. But for me, it's just really become this imaginary best friend just that I talk to all day. I talk to the universe. People can say I'm talking to myself. I look for signs from the universe. I just know that there is an energy that's guided me countless times in my life that you have to look for and believe in and allow in order to interact with it. So I have jokes going with the universe. You know, we just have this really great relationship. And I do try to, especially in my joy classes, more in the joy classes than the writing classes, though I probably do, you know, in the writing classes, it just becomes the muse and the source for inspiration. But I do rely on that on a daily basis, rely on my interaction with the universe, the energies of all that is.
Do you find that it ever inhibits your ability to express your ideas with certain groups, whether they're, you know, heart scientists or, you know, skeptics, or for that matter, within institutions like our public school systems?
That's funny you mentioned that. I used to worry about that, and I don't anymore. And I think it's just because I've never found anyone to object. And maybe it's the way I present it. I don't use the word God, though I'm fine with the word God. I don't use it because I know some people have associations there that I don't want them to make. But I teach this stuff in the public schools all the time. And I used to worry about it when I realized I was getting more and more woo-woo with my presentations. But I go into the public schools with creativity as the banner. It's always about being more creative. And I go to high schools and junior highs and universities, elementary schools. And it's they think I'm going to come in and talk about your writing and your music and your artwork, the ways that schools think about creativity. And then I don't. I gloss over that. I talk about it a little bit, but I really am talking about creation, about how you create yourself the way you want to be, how you create your life and your circumstances and outcomes. And I think it's not what the administration is expecting when they bring me in, but somehow it always ends up to be fine. They don't object. They like, what an interesting approach on creativity, and wow, the students are really excited about it now. And I think if I had ever had a situation where it had been an issue, I might be more concerned, but since I haven't.
And I would assume you get, you know, they invite you back.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. When you think of yourself, Lisa, how do you describe yourself and your life's goals and ambitions?
Oh, I'm such a work in progress, and I love that. I would hate to think that I had finished anything. I just love the ever-expanding nature of how my life has turned out, you know, to be what I've come to embrace, and I love learning from other people in this industry. Is that the right answer? Is that what you're looking for?
You know, there is no right answer. I mean, I happen to share your answer, so, I mean, I can applaud it from this end. What we try to do is, of course, flesh out the human being. So many people think of their own limitations, think of how unique they are, or, you know, the difficulties they've been saddled with in life, and it's due to those things that they are stuck. And one of the things that we wanted to really bring out in this show, by bringing the very best of what they do on, and you are the best of what you do, was illustrate that, you know, successful people typically aren't coming from a fast track. They're coming from a lot of obstacles themselves. They, you know, like yourself, that maybe you weren't popular in school. Maybe indeed you did have problems expressing yourself. And maybe, you know, there were underlying reasons for that, you know, fearful psychology and so on, all due to your primary caretaker. And we could get into that, but to answer your question, a work in progress is how I see all of us. I don't see success as a destination, as that great, you know, slogan goes. It's, you know, it's really a journey. It is a process. It is a progress. And my favorite question is, how high is up? So it doesn't matter what pinnacle you're standing on, what limb you're on, you know, the tree grows ever taller, if you will, so you can climb ever higher. Does that answer your question, Lisa?
I think so.
Okay. Listen, while we're on that then, what I'd like you to do is, I mean, if you're like most successful people, you've endured some trying times. Tell us, what were some of the darker moments in your life?
I never had one of those dark nights of the soul that you read about, you know, where the book starts, where you're slitting your wrists in the bathtub, or, you know, you've had this huge crisis. It was more a gradual accumulation for me. I really look back and I feel like I had such blinders on for so much of my life that it's been a gradual peeling away toward joy. And joy was not, you know, something that I ever really believed in. I thought people who seemed happy were fake, you know, or just like, because nobody could really have all that joy, right? It was just something that seemed elusive or false. And gradually discovering that it's not only real, but it's something that can be practiced and learned, I think was a huge epiphany for me. But I think I just became numb at a lot of different points in my life. And really, that's as close to a dark night of the soul as I had gotten. I was very... I stayed in a marriage too long that was numbing and not fulfilling. And I talk about I love studying the law of attraction. I love the Hicks. I love all the law of attraction material. But for a while, I was practicing it in a very dangerous way because I thought that finding the silver lining in any situation, finding something to be happy about and focusing on that was going to changed my whole life around. I seriously bought into that. And what it did was make me so narrowly focused that I couldn't see any of the things in my life that really did need adjustment and need changing, because I was fearful of change. I was fearful of you know, speaking my mind. So I sort of used the law of attraction principles as an excuse not to address anything. So I definitely stayed in some, you know, jobs too long, relationships too long, because of, I can find the good in this. I can make this work. I can find something to be happy about here.
All right. You say you practiced. Does that mean that mm-hmm. you literally practiced being happy in order to be happy?
No, I found that, I mean, maybe when I was really trying to just always reach for that better thought, as they say in Hicks terminology, I was practicing being happy. But that's when the whole authenticity piece sort of clicked into place for me. I realized that joy is not about happiness. It's really about being okay with whatever we're feeling and finding that kernel of joy in it. If you're fully accepting yourself and you're not judging yourself and you're loving who you are, sadness has joy in it. Anger has joy in it. Even shame or envy, those things we judge people for, there can be joy in any emotion if you're allowing it. And that's how I think I came over from the happy, happy all the time, big, big smile to authentic joy, is by learning to embrace the whole spectrum. And if you're angry about something, any emotion that you're feeling is a gift from this source energy, this beautiful universe that loves and adores me. It's alerting me to something. So if I feel sadness or I feel anger, I learn to kind of accept it enough to wallow in it long enough to hear the message and feel the joy in that and be grateful for that anger or that sadness, because then I know what my next steps are and I've received the message and it can just flow through. The reason that we don't want those feelings is we resist them, and the resistance is what causes the suffering, not the feeling itself. The feelings can all be beautiful gifts.
As the Dalai Lama says, adversity is not suffering. It's what our mind does with the suffering. All right. You basically tell us that, you know, you relationships didn't work well. Where are you with relationships today?
That was one of my last pieces, Alden, that, you know, with all of my manifestation glories and all the things I teach in my workshops, we always, you know, here are the different areas of your life, and that one was the one that really had me stuck, because after I, you know, left my marriage, I had this vision. I knew how to think about it and create it. I was teaching people how to do it, but I started doubting the whole process because it wasn't showing up. I wasn't having that click that I envisioned. And I think that the desire to partner up is in every human being somewhere buried under there. And so often the desire overrides our better judgment on, you know, who we're partnering up with. And there are so many factors in how we do that. I know that for a while, when you develop a survival instinct like I did on how, you know, how to deal with somebody that you have to walk in eggshells around, that survival instinct is a pattern that's running, right? I mean, you, of all people, know exactly what I'm talking about. So I did create a series of partners who had that same dynamic going with me, where I had to be so careful and do everything right to please them, or they'd fly off the handle. And of course, that's not, you know, for a happy partnership, happy existence. So I had corrected all this energetically. I knew what I was looking for, and he wasn't showing up, and he wasn't showing up, and then he did. And it was just one of those things where, from really the first four sentences between us, it was that, ah, oh, there you are. Okay, where have you been? Great, let's get on with it. So I'm very happily partnered.
Cool. I like the story. All right, let me ask you this before we really get into the meat of what it is that you do and you teach today, although I think, you know, you are telling us what you teach because you teach from where you've been. That's pretty well true, is it not?
Oh, sure. I think everybody does if they're teaching effectively.
Okay. What challenges did you face that you would consider to be the more difficult ones in, you know, meeting the success level that you have today?
I think it's really all of our challenges, not to get too esoteric, but I think they're all really internal battles. I think we do create what we're expecting. And, you know, there were times when my expectation wasn't high enough. I didn't really believe that I could have success. And I think that correcting that on an energetic level, correcting my own beliefs about that, is what opened up the door to greater and greater success. But I think that just really tying in with the authenticity, I would say, is the greatest challenge. It, even though metaphysics and spirituality was my passion for my whole life, it took me until a few years ago to write about it. It was always a closet passion. So getting okay with coming out of the closet with these beliefs that a lot of people are going to challenge, and wait, nobody should ever challenge me. I don't want to put myself ever in a position where anybody might not just like me, you know? So right. It was those internal challenges that were the hardest, I think, just coming out with, hey, this is what I believe, this is what's working with me, and I'm going to share it with you because it's the hardest thing for me to do, so I'm going to do it.
I love the attitude. Did you ever just consider throwing the towel in? I mean, you know, and hiding, and the heck with it, I'm going to do something else?
I think, you know, I was writing kids' books for a long time, and I was having success with that, so there was a lot of pressure to continue that, and I did, you know, basically decide to just throw in the towel there because I just wasn't feeling it anymore. It wasn't my passion. I was starting to feel like I was an imposter children's book writer. So I have thrown in the towel, and I don't think there's anything really wrong with throwing in the towel when it's time to, when the guidance tells you to.
Okay, but what I meant was, you know, quitting on this, what you call, you know, your progress, the work in progress. Did you ever just come to a point where maybe the people around you didn't provide support, or you had enough doubt that you just thought about, you know, that's it, I quit, throw in the towel, like, you know, the prize fighter who quits the ring and leaves?
No. I think I always had this inner world that I could retreat to. And it's a writer's world. I mean, we get better at whatever we do, right? That's the premise of words and everything else. The more hours you put in, the more practice, the better you get. And when the world was kind of giving me a lot of contrast, I would retreat to my own private writer's place because that was always my salvation, was writing, whether it was my journals or stories or fiction, just to work things out. And that just always led me further down the writer's path, I guess, since that would be my go-to when I'm feeling pressure from the outside world. It just sort of fueled itself. So no, I never wanted to throw in the towel on writing.
Let me ask you this then. Was there ever a time that you felt crowned, victorious? You know, you said to yourself, I've made it, you know, I've done what I came to do.
It was really thrilling for me to have the Hay House contract, just because y'all were my heroes. I mean, you are my heroes. You and the Hay House authors, these were the people that I looked up to more than anything. And the thought of me with my little workshops that I've been doing, writing up a book about it and getting to, in effect, join the ranks there, that had to have been the most crowning glory moment, I think, of my career, was starting to call myself a Hay House author.
All right, I like that. I'll take that. What would you do differently today, Lisa, if you had it all to do over again?
Oh, it's so cliche to say not a thing, but seriously, not a thing. I mean, all of the contrast, if you look back at how one thing led to the next, I feel like the tiniest little alteration anywhere along the way, I could be somewhere completely different, right? It's that, like, comet trajectory analogy where, you know, if the comet just moves the tiniest little inch, it's going to completely miss the planet. I feel like I'm exactly where I'm supposed to be, and I adore every person in my life who has led me to get to where I am now through the negative events and the positive events.
You know,
is that copping out on the question?
No, that is more juicy joy. I'm gonna give you one before we go to break, and then when we come back, we're gonna jump into your workshops and what you do. But I know you well enough that you can answer this question. But I wanted to, well, I won't even say that because it will come from your heart. What is it, Lisa, that you gain other than monetary reward for what you do? And please provide an example.
What is it that I gain from what I do? Oh my gosh, I talk a lot in my seminars about our driving needs. I believe that early in our lives, we all sort of have unmet needs that become our drive for everything. And I know as a young person, my just what I wanted, what I craved more than anything was connection with people, deep, meaningful connection, not surfacey fake connection, but real soul-to-soul connection. And I didn't have it, and I wasn't good at it. And, you know, the fact that now I just automatically, from the first, you know, moment that I'm on the phone with a new client or something, I'm connecting on that level with people is just like a dream come true. It's what I'm here to do, and it went from being something I never had in my life to just being my whole life, all my connections now. You know, I've weeded out every friend who wanted to just relate to me on that surfacey level, and now I'm just surrounded by people that I can connect with, and that spills over into the work I do, because if you're not bringing your most authentic raw self to the page, you're writing drivel, and I don't care how smart you are, how articulate you are, how interesting you are, if you're not connecting with me as a reader, you're not going to get anywhere in my course. It's that connection that definitely I help people bring to the page, and that feeds me in the work that I do.
And that's a feeling that you take to bed, maybe like my warm fuzzies?
Yes, like I know Revenger's your warm fuzzy. That was so cute. You guys are adorable. Yes, that is the feeling that just permeates the work that I do. And if I'm having a day or a client where that feeling isn't there, I know that's the direction we have to work on. We have to get to that soul-to-soul connection place before any progress is going to be made.
That's when you know your life makes a difference. To me, that is what the warm fuzzy is all about, you know. We all, whether we like to admit it or not, you know, as the poet says, though our hearts are stout and brave, still like distant drums, they're beating funeral marches to the grave. We all need to recognize that part of our life and then make every moment a cherishable moment. This one is her third favorite.
I'm a bad boy, 'cause you don't even miss her. I'm a bad boy for breaking her heart.
Welcome back. If you just joined us, we're chatting with Lisa McCord about her life, her work, and her books. And Lisa, that's your third song. You sent that over, Free Falling by Tony Bennett, or Tom Bennett. Petty, I guess. I'll get it said here correctly. I'm a bad boy. I'm not a bad boy. What do you mean I'm a bad boy?
It's funny that you picked that line out. It is one of my favorite lines in the song. And I think it's just, you know, he's talking about leaving a relationship, but it could be about leaving anything, and knowing that that's what it looks like, because, you know, she's this good girl, crazy about Elvis, loves horses and her boyfriend too. And he's okay. He's owning it. You know what? I'm a bad boy because I don't even miss her. I'm a bad boy for breaking her heart. And to me, it's such a liberating song to know that you can leave a bad situation, whether it's a relationship or whatever it is. It doesn't matter what it makes you look like. I counsel a lot of people with divorce.
Are you there, Lisa?
Apparently we are live still. We have lost Lisa.
We've lost Lisa.
But we are here, which is such a,
okay.
It's a shame, because I was really enjoying Lisa.
Yeah, I was
so
too.
Hopefully we can get her back.
The studio
real
will
quick.
Get her back. All right. Well, there's a little bit of a hiccup here. I thought we had lost our connection with the studio. Actually, we broadcast the live show from my ranch, our ranch, not mine. My wife makes me do the painting of the fences, but
hey, I was the one doing the painting.
Well, now, why do you think I said that? All right. in Spokane, Washington, and we use the modern technology, codec solutions, if you will, to connect live to the studio in Seattle. Actually, Bellevue, right? Bellevue, Bellingham. I always get the two mixed up.
Bellevue,
that's what I thought. Well, we've been inside the studio, but at any rate, I assume that we are attempting to get Lisa back, and I'm waiting for someone in the studio to inform me of that. And the betwixt time, Ravinder, let's talk about Lisa's interview so far. We both know Lisa. She is a very effervescent, outgoing person who has really set a lot of records as an author, written some great books. And in fact, I've interviewed her before on just her book, and we're going to talk about that if we get her back here. Juicy Joy, Seven Simple Steps to Glorious Gutsy Self. And yet, you know, here's a person who couldn't express herself as a child, who was afraid to express herself, who apparently couldn't write or didn't write legibly enough or dark enough, that's what I want to say, didn't press hard enough in order for the teachers to see what she had written, and didn't speak loud enough for her answers to be audible to people around her. So she really, you know, she really had some strong insecurities with regard to that. And yet, as she has told us, she basically has taken those insecurities and turned them into her strengths. And isn't that what we've heard over
and
over?
We are seeing that time and time again during the Breaking Limitations series. You know, it's not the successful people aren't those who had the silver spoon in their mouth. They're the ones who made the different choices, the choice to come out of it and to make lemonade out of the lemons.
And that's really exactly what she did. Yes, that's exactly what she did. I remember Joan Borisenko's conversation where, you know, for all intent and purposes, she stopped working on cells and started working with humans only because her father got cancer and she couldn't stand how he was treated.
Yeah.
I think we have Lisa back on the line. Are you there with us now, Lisa?
Yes, I am. I had been just talking and talking.
Oh, you've been talking, you know, and we missed all of that. So why don't you do some talking and fill us in?
Well, now I don't even remember what the question was. Oh, we're talking about the song, the Free Falling
yes,
song.
That's right.
But I don't know at what point y'all stop hearing me, so I don't want to repeat myself.
Well, I think you basically started to tell us. I mean, this is what we heard on this end before silence, that you found that it was okay to, you know, move away from a bad situation and that, you know, you weren't really a bad person for doing that.
Yeah.
Did I miss out something?
There's so much victim-villain mentality in any kind of a breakup like that where the person who wants to leave is always the villain, and it just creates this whole situation that can be avoided when we just realize that comings and goings are often just a natural part of our growth and our life. And the chorus, the free falling, I find really a beautiful metaphor for flowing through life, just letting life happen as it's supposed to happen.
Change is difficult for everyone. And one of the things that happens often when we change is that the people around us don't change. And so it's not at all uncommon for a person to look back on their life and see that, well, they're not surrounded by the same people that they were surrounded with, 15, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Any of that truth in your life?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There have been several times where I've really shed whole groups of friends and people, and unlovingly so, not with any malice or judgment.
Sure.
It's just, I need soul-to-soul connection. I need to feel like someone really gets me and I really get them. Otherwise, the relationship is just kind of taking up space in my life. So when that real connection fails to be there, I do move away from relationships.
Don't you think that that's perhaps one of the hardest things about change is the idea that we have to make, you know, we have to make sacrifices. We have to give things up. I mean, change is about giving things up, and often that includes people.
Yeah, it does. And I think in divorce scenarios in particular, it's so criminalized in our society. You know, it's still, even though it's so prevalent, it's still something that you know you're going to get a lot of flack for. So if you want to leave a marriage, the default is to, I don't want to be the villain, so I'm going to make you the villain. I'm going to make this list of all the reasons that you're impossible to be married to, and then you're looking for those reasons. And, of course, we all know whatever we're looking for is what we're going to find, and it creates this animosity that doesn't have to be there if we could just say it's okay that we've grown apart and we're going to go different ways. But because we know that divorce is going to be looked upon, or if you're the one who wants to go, you're going to be looked upon as the bad guy by all your friends, It just sets up this polarity that is a shame, really, because often, you know, it could be avoided. You don't have to find all the worst things in your partner in order to leave a relationship.
Totally true. You know, the jurisprudence system sets up a blame game, you know, and unfortunately, you're absolutely right. There should be just a basis for divorce that is, we grew apart, you know, period, end of quotation. We like each other, but that isn't where things are today. On the other hand, I suppose, in all fairness, marriages work best when we recognize that, you know, there are good years and there are bad years, and they just come as a part of the package. But all right, here's our big question. the one our audience has been waiting for. What one or two tangible tips do you have for our audience that they can employ today to change their lives for the better based on your life experience?
I would say one of the easiest things to do is to just set an intention to be more aware of and welcoming of your emotions on a daily basis. You wake up, you say, I'm going to pay attention to every emotion today, because we all have emotions that we don't want to feel, and we'll try to sort of push those away unconsciously. But letting them in, welcoming them, finding the joy in them, getting the message from them, just starts to get you in touch with that inner voice that for most of us is long buried under a whole bunch of what we think people expect of us and the expectations we put on ourselves. We lose touch with that inner voice, and our feelings are the way to start to get to it. There are a lot of writing exercises that I could get people to do for that, but those would take more than a few minutes. But really, just, I tell people sometimes, make it a goal every hour to touch in and see how you're feeling. And you could do it just maybe every time you look at the clock and see what time it is. Make that a cue to just take a few seconds to just go inward. What am I feeling? And then once you take inventory of that, you want to say, what is it that I want to feel? What would be something that I really would like to be feeling? And you put your attention and focus on that. And the universe responds to that. Wherever we put our attention and focus, that's what's going to become apparent to us. It could be as simple as, I feel kind of claustrophobic and stuffy. I think, I'll open this window and I'll feel better. And then you would. But if you hadn't taken that moment to check in, you wouldn't know that. And another one is really just to find ways to love yourself. And I know that's so much easier said than done. You can make a list, do a writing prompt where if I were completely adoring and accepting of myself, it would be for what reasons, and just see what comes after that, and keep that list and treat it like gold and read it several times a day until you start to feel your feelings towards yourself shift. Because when you have all these self-judgments that most of us are walking around with, a tremendous load of self-judgments, it makes you more judgmental of other people. It blocks experiences from being available to you. I know we've talked before, Eldon, about what I call the filter, that energetic membrane that separates us from the rest of the world, even though we all know there really is no separation, right? I'm energy, right? You're energy. We're all just swimming in this giant vat of energy soup. But it feels like there's a separation, because what each of us represents in the soup is just a point of perception. We are just perceiving everything else in the soup. And we have all these limitations and beliefs woven into our filters, force-breaking limitations, but all these beliefs are deciding how we perceive the world. And every moment, I used to say 7,000, that's what I had read once. Now I just recently read it's like some huge number, even bigger than that. 7,000 bits of information are available to us. And of course, we're not consciously processing all of that information. So how do we decide what bits of information come through into our conscious awareness and which ones are blocked out? Is just this filter, this energetic membrane of beliefs. So becoming more aware of our emotions and taking the steps to see what those beliefs are and rewiring them allows us to see the whole spectrum of opportunities that might be closed off to us otherwise. So I think it begins with just a really simple awareness practice. What am I feeling? What are the messages from this feeling? What do I want to be feeling? And that can start to shift the filter a little bit so that things are available to you, opportunities that you might not have noticed otherwise. And then loving on yourself. And you can't just pay lip service to self-love either. You can't just say, that sounds like a good idea. I think I'm going to love myself this week. You have to make it concrete. You have to go do something for you that's really a solid announcement to the universe, to your higher consciousness, that I'm serious about this. I love myself. I deserve this. I'm going to be more accepting of me. And then, when you take concrete action on it, that's what starts to draw more into your life as well.
Let me ask you this. I love your answer, by the way. I tend to think of it as the problem with the pronoun I. We happen to live in a culture where our language separates us. And when we think of, there's I, and then there's you, and, you know, I and all the objects in the universe. And in reality, you know, as you say, we're really all energetic beings in a sea of energy, and at an ultimate quantum level, that's precisely what we are. And I like the way you put that. You know, we basically are packing a perspective that is defining ourselves, not just as separate from everything else, but defining how we see ourselves, our beliefs, our life beliefs. And you and I have talked about that, so I'm on the same page with you. Let me ask you this. What is the deal? I mean, why is joy such a buzzword for you?
Joy? Joy, the way I define it, which is not happiness, but just the ability to feel all your feelings. You know, I think it's just for the reasons that I've discussed, that first of all, from a law of attraction perspective, it's the real joy, the genuine joy, the knowing yourself, the loving yourself that's going to open the doors to the things that you want, as opposed to people who maybe are immature in their understanding of the law of attraction, which I certainly was when I began practicing it, you know, thinking that you have to shut off certain emotions because they're going to draw bad things into your life. So I guess joy in the full sense of the word, finding the joy in every emotion, is kind of, to me, what I believe allows people to have the things that they want in their lives.
But is the joy in the emotion, or is the joy in processing the information and realizing what the message is? I mean, I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out. Are you, your appendix ruptures, will be it, but... you know, you're confronted with a pain, a very serious pain. Now, you know, there are lots of things that people are taught, or lots of ways that people are taught to deal with pain. My question is, are you finding joy in the pain, or are you finding joy in the message behind the pain, or both?
It really goes into a big area with lots of parts to it, but if my appendix ruptured, you know, once I got past the momentary first reaction, what I would try to go to is, there's definitely I do believe there's a reason for everything that happens to us. And maybe if this is going to be, you know, a life and death situation, then, you know, what am I going to learn from this? What am I going to look back and find out about myself through this experience? And just feel the pain of it, but know that it's here for a reason, that I'm going to look back at some point and be grateful for this appendix rupturing time in my life. If it disrupts my work for whatever period of time that might be, that's a disruption that I'm going to look back and be grateful for, because I was headed in a wrong direction and now I'm going down a better path. Or I think that while it sounds kind of Pollyanna to say that every bad situation, something good is going to come from it, I do believe that we create our whole world through our beliefs, and I get to choose my beliefs. So why not choose to believe that every bad thing that's going to happen to me is going to lead to something that I'll be grateful for? It sounds like a crazy belief, but if I get to choose my beliefs, then my beliefs are going to create what happens. Why not choose that belief? It's panned out for me so far.
Well, and I'll tell you, the data shows that pragmatically, that is absolutely the best attitude to have. In fact, it's something that I teach. I just came off a couple of lectures where we tell stories and give examples of that. You can anticipate the situation as being, you know, the worst possible thing, or why did this happen to me, or take the victim role, and so on and so forth. And all that does is arrest the optimal operation of, you know, little things like your immune system, your endocrine system, and your autonomic nervous system. Or you can take the approach that you're teaching, and what we find is it actually optimizes that operation. It shifts your focus entirely. You seem to be teaching a kind of mindfulness, if you will, Lisa, that is an emotional mindfulness. I mean, mindfulness traditionally is all about attending to, you know, what we're thinking, and attending to it without judgment. But you're talking about feeling your emotions and checking in with your emotions. And tell me, you know, when you check in with your emotions, do you attenuate that with, I wonder why I'm feeling that way? Do you do rational kinds of linguistic processes to source those feelings? Do you judge those feelings? Is it a kind of mindfulness of emotion?
It's definitely a mindfulness of emotion, yes. And I think there have been times in my life where I was very rational about it and would try to mentally decipher what is the message here, and I've really gotten away from that. I think that that just sort of takes us in these mental spirals that could go round and around, and it, to me, it becomes an intuitive practice where you really feel in your body what the message is. And usually that question, that follow-up question, okay, here's what I'm feeling, what is it that I would like to feel, is usually the valve that opens the, you know, the messaging system from the universe that will sort of let you know what that feeling is there for. And it's always just showing you the direction to go in. It's just a pointer. We go toward the things that make us feel good, and we go away from the things that make us feel bad. And, of course, there's examples that would be counter to that of, you know, people using drugs or you know, eating to excess. But when you really check in with your body, I think you feel the answers. You feel the things that are good for you and the things that aren't, just through the developing that intuitive voice, that connection with your more authentic self.
I mean, maybe this is the tool, but is there any, you know, tool or thing that you do that keeps you from getting stuck, emotionally stuck, mentally stuck, etc.?
I know this will surprise you. Writing is the tool. For me, there's nothing that can possibly compare. It just opens up that gateway. And whether it's joy clients or writing clients, a lot of times there'll be this resistance. I just don't, you know, I don't feel like I want to write. I don't know what I would say. I don't have anything to say. Well, duh, it's like trying to pour a glass of milk with the top on the jug. You know, you don't know what you're going to say until you start. You have to start the writing, and that takes the top off the jug so that the milk can flow, so that the words can flow. That's why so much of the practice that I do with writers has to do with prompts, to make them, you know, just start answering this question. That gives you something to focus on to initially get into it. And it just, it allows that flow to start coming out. And I have gone places in my writing where, you know, I start with one question I have about my life, and I'll just sort of write the question and write a few buzzwords of what I'm feeling about it. And then it overtakes you. You have no idea where it's going to go, or you shouldn't have any idea. When you're trying to manipulate the writing too much, you're limiting the potential for the flow to happen. And it answers your questions, and you sort of start to decipher the different voices in your head then. Okay, this voice is my mom's, or this voice is something from, you know, society and trying to protect myself. But there it is. It's like a groove that you find, that worn groove of, there's the voice of my higher knowing. There's that connection to source, to universe. But to me, I have to be writing to really open that gateway.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me, and of course, you know, you teach writers how to be writers. I guess you teach people how to become writers. We're all writers in a sense. We're, you know, but your courses would have more value, or wouldn't have as much value. Maybe get it said right here. They'd have as much value to somebody who didn't want to become a writer per se. They just really wanted to become authentic. You just really wanted to take a step in their own journey of, you know, self-growth, self-improvement. Is that right, or am I way wrong there?
No, absolutely. That is the goal for a lot of the people in the Write Your Juice course. Is they weren't especially drawn to writing, but they're willing to try it as a tool. You know, maybe people who have tried other tools, and this is just going to be another tool for them for self-exploration, to work out childhood stuff, to work out limitations. Yeah, I'd say more of the people who come to the course do have some interest in writing, but I definitely have people who are just there to explore themselves, to get to know themselves better.
Tell me about the course. Tell us, what is your course? What's involved in your course?
There are downloadable classes that people listen to, and every month there's an open call, and you can send questions in advance of the call. And truthfully, I do address a lot of the questions personally, you know, via email or a private call, but I don't advertise that because I'm not, you know, sure I would always be able to do that. But I do answer the questions on the call. I have guests in to talk about their own writing process, or especially if, you know, we're focusing on memoirs. If a lot of the people in the group at that time are writing memoirs, I'll have people who have written memoirs in and talk about their process. And it's just really a little bit of hand-holding. It often does go into, I have another program, Soul Writing Partnerships, that I do more one-on-one with people, where it often turns into a ghostwriting situation, somebody who just has a lot to say, but those are usually the people who are very serious about publication, and I'll end up ghostwriting for them. And sometimes it's just a little bit more hand-holding to get them through their own manuscript, but the course itself is more of a group format.
All right. We've got a break coming up. When we come back, I want to flesh out a little bit of what you just explained to us about what your course is. Now that I understand that it's all online or over the telephone or something, you know, you can. This is something you can do from anywhere in the world. We hope you're enjoying our show today with Lisa McCord and our discussion about her books, life, and work. You can visit her website to learn more about what's going on with Lisa by going to Lisa McCourt, that's LisaMcCourt.com. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes and take your calls, so do stay tuned.
You're listening to Provocative Enlightenment with Elton Taylor.
We're all very aware of the power of belief, but are you aware that many times it is your inner beliefs that cause you to sabotage your own dreams and goals? Success is so much more likely when your inner beliefs are in line with your outer goals. And now, using Eldon Taylor's InnerTalk technology, you can do just this. InnerTalk is a patented subliminal technology and is the only such technology to be researched by numerous independent universities and institutions, including Stanford, and been demonstrated effective at priming your self-talk. There are hundreds of titles to choose from, ranging from weight loss to esteem, organized and efficient to prosperity and abundance, attracting the right love relationship to winning sports performance, accelerated learning to accelerated healing. Eldon Taylor's patented InnerTalk technology is your key to success. Check it out today. Visit www.innertalk.com. That's InnerTalk.com. InnerTalk.com.
Do you feel like you've become lost in a funhouse, only seeing the reflection of yourself, past, future, and present, but unable to find the real you? I invite you to step through the doorway and onto the path leading to understanding of your mind, your choices, and the influences that surround you. Read Eldon Taylor's New York Times best-selling book, Choices and Illusions, now expanded, updated, and revised. It will provide you with real-life examples of how you can break free from your current perceptions and begin your journey to how high is up. Get your copy today from all bookstores or online from Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble.
Now, back to the show.
And welcome back. If you just joined us, we're speaking with Lisa McCourt about her books, life, and work. We'll take your phone calls in this half hour, so if you have questions of our guest, if you just ever wanted to talk to this lovely person, either give us a call or submit your question in our chat room. Ravinder and her team, Andrea and Jana, are there to put your questions forward. Okay, so let's get back to the show. All right, Lisa, let me ask you this. How do joy and authenticity affect manifestation?
Well, the authenticity piece to me, I lump them together, authenticity and self-love. And I find that with all of the manifestation practices that are taught, that are worthwhile and people employ, the thing that almost always trips them up is that really final piece of knowing that they deserve the thing that they want to manifest. It's not that hard to make things happen in the world, but to receive them and to receive joy from them, even more importantly, really requires a level of authenticity and self-love that most of us are not walking around with, because if we had it and we knew that we deserved this thing, it would already be in our lives. So the thing that people are trying to manifest, the partner or the money or the fame or the position, more often the piece that is out of alignment in their manifestation practice is knowing that they deserve it, knowing that this should come to them, and that comes from the self-love place. And then joy, I mean, that's just a big old duh. That's what the whole law of attraction is about, is vibrating at the frequency of the thing that you want. If there's something out there that's, I use the example of a partner because that's something that a lot of people want, and it's easy to measure vibrational frequency of people. If you want a joyful relationship, you're going to need a joyful partner, and you're not going to be able to attract that until you yourself have reached a certain level of comfort and peace with your life. And I think so often we just focus on attracting a partner without cleaning up our own energy first, and we're going to attract a partner who's at a similar energetic level to wherever we are. And if neither one of us is particularly joyful, it's not going to be a joyful relationship.
How very, very true. Tell me this. You talk a lot about core needs and how they drive us. I mean, what's been your core need throughout all of your life?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, it's really the connection piece. I went so long without being able to have meaningful connections with people that I'm grateful for those circumstances, because that's what has allowed me to make that really a point in my study, in my personal evolution. And I just enjoy it so much now. And, as I'm sure a lot of your guests have talked about, it's the contrast that allows you to really enjoy something so much, right? If I had never dealt with issues around authenticity or connection, I would probably just take that for granted. But since I did have that huge struggle with it throughout my life, it's something that I'm just so grateful for every day now. And I think that's part of the beauty in recognizing the gift in the contrast and gift in the unwanted circumstances, is it does allow you to appreciate things so much more when you finally achieve them.
All right, now we've got some questions that have come into the chat room. One of them is a tough one. I'm going to take the easy one first, all right? Mm-hmm. Kathy wants to know, how long on average did it take you to write the children's book that you've written? And she continues, did she just do it or go into a flow of consciousness to write?
For the children's books? My very first children's book was I Love You, Stinky Face, and that one, I really do have to say, it just kind of came in a rush. It wasn't something that I struggled with. I hadn't really planned to write a children's book. I was working in publishing. I was familiar with children's books. My last official career as a person in New York who was working in publishing was as a book club director for the school book clubs, the kids bring home those little flyers and you want to order books. I used to choose all the books, so I understood the children's book industry very well, but had left it and was, had my own sort of company that I had started when I moved down to Florida, and that just came to me in a rush. I was pregnant at the time. I had just found out I was pregnant, so I had no idea if it was going to be a boy or a girl, if this being was going to have anything in common with me, and I just loved this creature so much. And the whole book, I Love You, Stinky Face, just sort of poured out in I was actually making egg salad when the words started going through my head. But I always tell writers, too, that every character that we write is a piece of us. And if we authentically, can look at how that character is like us, even the most horrible villain characters, there's a piece that's like that in us where we can't write the character authentically. So that story is a child character and a mom character, and the mom character is just me. It's absolutely my personality, my voice. But even the child character, I really can see in retrospect how it represented me at the time, because it's this little nervous what if. What if this happened? Would you still love me? What if this? Would you still love me? And I think that just being newly pregnant and hearing about varicose veins and night sweats and all these things that happened, you know, sickness, I think that I was sort of feeling like I was turning into a monster, and that's what the character in the book does. It turns into various monsters, and had that little voice of, you know, will you still love me? Will you still love me if, you know? So that one did come in a rush of instance.
That's a wonderful story. Yeah. as my wife would say, that's romantic. That's a romantic story. All right. This is not so romantic. Richard from our chat room says, the whole manifestation secret thing is something Eldon has railed against numerous times. Could he focus on the veracity of this with Lisa? Ask a hard question.
Okay. All right.
And I will do that. And let me just tell you where I am on that. There is no such thing as a law of attraction, in my opinion. Period, end of quotation. For it to be a law, it would be regular and reliable. And like gravity, I would only need to float upwards once when I stepped out of my office to forever be hanging on to something thereafter. There are many examples. I do believe that we attract of kind. There's no question in my mind about that. I do believe in the power of positive thinking, and we explain away many things that are attributed to the law of attraction through science. We call them perhaps the Pygmalion factor, or we call them the expectation factor. There are solid explanations without resorting to this notion of quantum physics and how energy attracts energy, etc. That has been my issue. I've let you go because you haven't been teaching the law of attraction. You've been talking about how you've used it, including how it didn't serve you. I think Richard's entire issue here has to do with the fact that I have in the past, on repeated occasions, taken authors to task who want to tell me about quantum physics of the law of attraction, or who want to tell me about the infinite truth that exists in what they see as a law that isn't a lot more than what Napoleon Hill taught us in his books, Think and Grow Rich. In other words, when you say law of attraction now, here comes your hard question. Are you framing that in its, and I'm going to make it as easy as I can for you, are you framing that in the context of the title, the popular use, or are you trying to tell us that this is a physical law in the universe?
I'm pondering that question.
I don't blame you.
When I read about law of attraction, or when I hear, you know, people talk about it, I guess the scientific angle interests me a little bit less than the application to life. So I've never given a lot of thought to it being called a law in the technically scientific way that laws are demonstrated. And I understand your gravity thing. The law of attraction certainly does not seem to be across the board. But I do believe that our personal energy, it goes back to my filter thing. I think that our beliefs are what are allowing us to see various things in our lives. Are you still... Eldon?
Yes, I'm here, and I like where you're going.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Our beliefs do, indeed. Okay. In fact, if I can interject something there.
I thought I had gotten dropped again. Okay, no, what I think happens with the law of attraction is that there are so many possibilities always available, and the only things that are allowed to come through, the only bits of information that come through and become our version of reality are the ones that are in accordance with our beliefs. And by shifting our beliefs, it opens up a whole new world. So that's what I mean by law of attraction, is just that you can't possibly bring into your life certain things when the beliefs are blocking you from seeing them. It's not that I think that the energy goes out and pulls things to me, magnetizes them to me, the way I've heard it sometimes described, as much as I believe that they're always there. I'm just not going to be able to intellectually perceive them until I shift my energy about that, my beliefs about that.
That's a great explanation. I might add the little caveat about it doesn't magnetically pull ever, as opposed to sometimes. But, you know, your beliefs do predispose that. Your attitude predisposes. You make a very good point when you're talking about, you know, relationship. If you're, you know, egotistical and self-centered and angry at the world and, you know, overconfident, and you think that what you're going to attract is someone into your life is going to bring balance, well, you're wrong. You know, that's the last thing that's going to happen. You don't have a happy person in your life if you're angry and miserable all the time. You're actually, my mother used to put it this way, birds of a feather flock together. It's that simple. To your point about belief, there's something I want to add here, as much for Richard's benefit as for anything else. I looked at a study just yesterday, a neuroscience study, and the study essentially was looking at theists and atheists from a standpoint of how they intellectually compared, processing syllogisms and things of this nature. One aspect of this looked at a Rorschach type of test, and theists and atheists were asked to pick out figures within these ink blots that were real figures. So what we had as a result of this particular test was the atheists were able to pick out every single real figure. The theists were able to pick out every single real figure, but they were also they also found other figures that weren't real figures by design. So there seemed to be a difference in what, you know, what their predisposition was toward which of the two elements they were able to find in the universe. You could be literal and direct, and that's all you saw, or you could, you know, be more expansive, and you seem to see more. Where the syllogism part of this was involved, and that became really important, The theistic syllogisms, and a theistic syllogism might be something like, and this, remember, syllogisms are just about internal consistency. So we're looking to see if the people are logical or not. So a theistic syllogism might say, John wants to be happy and live long. Religious people live long and are happy, therefore John becomes religious, okay? Within its internal sense, that is a consistent syllogism, whether you agree with the premises or not. It's premise A equals premise B. All right. An atheistic syllogism might well be something like, John wants to live a long life, free to experience everything. Religion restricts experience. Therefore, John is non-religious. Okay, so we had these two kinds of syllogisms. Now, what we found when they were presented in large mixes, and this was a very large group, the theists
were... The premise that religion restricts experience, I would want to argue. It depends on the religion.
Of course. Again, this is just an example. This would be an atheistic syllogism. So you had syllogisms that were both theistic, Lisa, and atheistic. And both teams, theist and atheist, both groups, I should say, experimental groups, were asked to determine what syllogisms were logically consistent within themselves. So I could have it, look, I could say, John Wayne is an actress. Actresses shave their armpits. Therefore, John Wayne shaves his armpits. Well, that's a totally fallacious statement in the real world, but it is a logical, consistent syllogism. If A equals B and B equals C, therefore A equals C. Okay, so that's all. That was what the syllogisms were. Now, the theistic group, they identified every single theistic syllogism correctly. And they identified the preponderance of atheistic syllogisms correctly. But the atheistic group failed to identify theistic syllogisms correctly. Well, they got all of the atheistic. So that tells us right there that if your belief system is such that it excludes a part of reality, you'll exclude it, even if it is a rational, logical outgrowth of something that's internally consistent, such as a syllogism. All right, enough on that point. Absolutely. Did you want to add something else?
I totally agree. It could be like you walk into a room, and if you happen to be a germaphobe, you're going to notice if anybody sneezes in that room, you're going to see all the dirt in the corners, you're going to feel like the desk that you're sitting at is grimy, and if you're not a germaphobe, you won't notice any of that. It's all where your focus is and where your expectation is. It's like it changes everything. None of us are experiencing reality the same exact way.
Amen. Very well said. All right. Mod Girl from the chat room says, what does Lisa see as the best way to trust your intuitive senses?
Practice them. It really is true. It's like, you know, the question of why do people get stuck? I don't really believe in stuck. I think it's just a matter of not having faith and not putting in the practice. Our beliefs, our lack of trust in our intuition is so habitual that it just takes a lot of repetition and a lot of use to start turning it around. And record your successes. Just play with it. Just, you know, go down the street and say, I wonder which direction that car is going to turn in. Oh, I got it right. And record it. Yep, I intuited which direction that car. Just play with it in nonsense ways and start to feel within your body when you have a hunch about something. Does it feel like an expansion or a contraction? And to me, it's all in the body, in the little hairs in the back of my neck, and the chills, and the way that my stomach feels or my chest feels. But until you start deliberately paying attention to it, it just goes beneath your conscious awareness. But once you really start just playing around with it and seeing how different impressions feel and different intuitions feel, you'll just, it'll become more and more prevalent. It's like anything that you give your attention to is going to grow in your life.
All right. Let me ask you this question, because I think it's pretty relevant to this stuff that we were talking about with regard to attraction. And you may have given us a pretty good example of this earlier, but tell us, you talk about how positive thinking can backfire. Give me an example of what you mean there.
I mean, I'll go to just what seems to be a very common example, and one that I definitely experienced in a broken relationship, in a relationship where there is no connection any longer, but there's nothing horrible going on. You know, a lot of counselors, a lot of, you know, people with well-meaning advice would be focus on what you love about your partner. And that can be the thing to bring the joy and the authenticity and the juice back into the relationship. It can work that way. But when it becomes the whole law of attraction package, and now I'm going to use law of attraction in, you know, the way that I think your detractors use it, where all you have to do is focus on the good, all you have to do is think better thoughts. No, that's denying ourselves. Our bodies, we are energetic beings, and our emotions are energies that reside within the energetic system that makes up us. So fighting against any emotion, pushing it away, denying it because you're afraid that feeling bad is going to bring more bad circumstances to you, is a form of self-loathing. You're denying yourself. You're denying that connection with your truest, most authentic voice. So to me, you have to listen when there's something that's pulling at you and making you feel sad or angry or any kind of distress. You have to be able to accept it and embrace it and trust that there's a reason that you're feeling the sadness. And the reason is that this partnership is not working for you. And sure, go through all the steps to try to make it something that works, but keep listening to the voice, because otherwise you're cut off from yourself.
Lisa, let me ask you this. It's one of your questions. It's something you submitted to me to ask you. Where are you still stuck, and what are you doing about it?
Okay. Well, it's always, as I said, an evolving journey for me. It's never done. And it's the self-love piece that's around my kids, because motherhood is such a loaded emotional package for me that I've gotten really good at my self-honoring. I do enjoy my own company so much. I love on me. All my emotions are fine, but I still feel like I need to put my kids' happiness before mine, and it's just a gray area that I'm working out. You know, that's, I know that I want to set the example for them of a fully functioning, self-loving adult out in the world. I want them to see that. I know that kids model themselves, you know, whatever I show them is how they're going to think this is how they need to go be in the world. So I hang on to that, but my default is still to really sacrifice myself for their happiness.
I think all of us as parents, I think all of us as parents get stuck in that one. So how do I mean, you vacillate back and forth? Is that the answer? Because that seems to be what we do around this ranch.
Yeah. and just really wanting to find the right balance for them, you know, because I know people who come into my trainings and who have suffered from parents who gave too much of themselves, and that is a very a tough burden for people to walk around with as well, parents who live through their children and give everything to their children, and then the children grow up with this sense of guilt and indebtedness. And, you know, so just finding that line, finding that perfect balance is sort of always a bit of a work in progress.
I'll tell you this, Lisa McCourt, you can be my teacher anytime. I love your energy. I love what you do. And I love the way you express it. I love also where you're coming from and the courage it's taken for you to get here. I appreciate you being here on our show today, and I think everybody else does too. My wife has got this wonderful smile on her face. She has done that several times to your answers. So I'm afraid we're out of time. We've come to the end of another episode of Provocative Enlightenment. And Lisa, I want to thank you very, very much for your honesty, for your candor, for joining us today, for sharing your time. I want to thank all of you out there for joining us today, and I hope you enjoyed our show, and we'll join us again next week, same time and same place. And please tell your friends. Let's have them all join as well. Remember to check out Lisa's website. It's Lisa McCourt. That's MCCOURT.com. All right, and remember, if you have comments on our show, do please let us know. You can write me, Eldon, at EldonTaylor.com. Okay, until next time, wherever you are in the world, remember, believing in yourself always matters.
Provocative Enlightenment has been brought to you by Progressive Awareness Research and other sponsors. Provocative Enlightenment is a syndicated show and appears on other networks. For a schedule of show times, visit ProvocativeEnlightenment.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, write to Eldon at EldonTaylor.com.